You're going to have a man speak to us tonight who, in my opinion, is open to change. Dr. Schuller, who has been on the faculty here since 1955, is a man who we recognize in the classroom as a man who is sensitive to the needs of the church, a man who is sensitive to the problems of the church. And so when we look back and see that for the past 2 years, since January 1st of 1964, that he has been working for the National Council of Churches in urban seminars, we begin to know that certainly here is a man who has been involved, who has been asking questions over the past 2 years. Where has the church been? Where is it going? Is the parish antiquated or out of date? Or what do we do now? With his work as director of these seminars, the seminars were for clergymen, he was able to lead the seminars on university campuses where the sociological and theological disciplines could be combined and where basic relevant questions could be fostered and asked. And so it is my great privilege to introduce the man speaking on the church and its social ministry, Dr. David Schuller.
Good to be back home again tonight. After the way the last couple of jokes have gone, I'm not going to take a chance. I would like to tell you that really a number of these things that you thought were songs and so forth were really tests. For example, that "We Wish You a Merry Christmas" was put in by the liturgics department. Any man who is a purist during Advent obviously is not going to be singing about Christmas. There was one man at each table noticing which ones were singing most robustly. And this is also why we sang six stanzas of all these other ones to see whether or not you could really come in at time. We're glad that Moon added that last one. I didn't know he could sing until he finally hit that last song. We discovered he did have a voice. What I'd like to do tonight, on the basis of the invitation of your committee, is to try to look at the church over against this whole broad aspect of its social concerns. The topic, as suggested by your chairman, was originally the church and social action. For those of you who are beginning to smile broadly and wondering why the rest are, we have a very lively bit of reminder of family life moving around in the front of the tables here. I still think it's rather nice when we're having a prayer in this august spot where you hear the sound of a child's voice coming through, as happened earlier. So as far as we're concerned, have him move around. It'll keep us related to the world on the outside. I'd like to start with a rather least common denominator. This is not an apology to those of you who have been working in this field for some period of time, but rather an attempt to say that as I've come back, I frankly have done so with some trepidation. I've come back having assured myself at the beginning I wanted to come back primarily to listen. I've been asking my colleagues, where are the men today? During a period of 2 years, it seemed obvious that changes had taken place. And so really, I'm talking before I feel I know where some of you are. So if you don't mind, let's start low and begin to move from that point. The least common denominator is we ask about the church as it moves out in this area of very broad social concern. I'd like to begin with two little case histories that will provide this common background. The first is just a snatch of a letter written by a university young man who is involved in an inner-city ministry in a Midwestern city. He wrote it to one of you on this campus. "I come to think more and more that anything short of either a massive federal program of people dedicated and sensitive, which government programs seldom attract, and money, 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 or a bloody class revolution that will make race riots look like Geneva peace conferences, something that if it's going to come may not be too far off but probably never will come, anything less than this will solve nothing." The letter was written before Watts. If people were genuinely, honestly, and openly concerned about the situation, there would be some hope, but very few are. We have scores of middle-class churchgoers who come from the suburbs saying they want to help. I'm afraid the only thing they really want is to help their consciences. They'll give parties for the kids and the old folks. They'll help with youngsters' groups at the center. But when we really get down to the core and begin trying to do something about slum landlordism, inadequate hospitalization, non-existent realistic treatment of alcoholics, bribed health inspectors, housing programs, and so forth, when we really get down to it, it becomes evident that the poor are poor because the rich are rich. When it becomes evident that the establishment is so firmly entrenched under the banner of the Puritan ethic that a man should work for what he gets, then our fine middle-class helpers begin to chant, "Wait, wait, young man," and we find that $5,000 has been withdrawn by the contributors because they didn't want us to do anything about the causes of poverty. They just wanted us to run a community center and church and maintain the status quo. As you reflect upon the first of these cases, I think you sense, as I do, the sense of pressure on the part of this man. And I think you find him reflecting the experience of many who are involved in this type of ministry, for example, in an inner city area. You find, furthermore, the charge of the domestication of the church. Is it possible for this group to somehow renew itself and to purify itself? Or does the change have to come from without? And perhaps we should add, finally, these men often seem on the verge of despair, with the feeling that we are hitting our heads against brick walls on both sides. The apathy of the group we're trying to help on the one side, and the apathy of the church and officialdom on the other. The second case history I'd like to present to you, in order to make sure that we're talking not in glowing generalities, but become specific, I'd like to have you think of a particular family living in a slum area of a particular Midwestern city. It's a family of six. You enter the antiquated, dilapidated building, which is their living quarters. You walk up a flight of stairs, which are in a state of serious disrepair. The hall has that pervasive odor that you've come to know, a combination of human bodies and tobacco and cheap whiskey and decaying wood. As you enter the family's apartment, you see at a glance all of their possessions. There's a large metal bed that dominates the room. The blankets are still lying as they fell when the last person arose that morning. A single bare bulb provides the only illumination for the entire room. There's a two-unit burner that provides all of the heat for the winter. Only one of the burners is working, and it's also the main source, the only source for cooking. There's a table with two chairs occupying the center of the room. There's still leftover food on the table, along with the dirty dishes. The number of tin cans scattered about the room that are serving as ashtrays. Most of them are full and overflowing under the floor. And now you turn your attention to the people who call this place home. And you look at the man. Chronologically, he's not very old yet, but he's already dying of sclerosis of the liver. His heavy drinking over the years has begun to take its toll. His story is told very simply. His formal education ended with the sixth grade. When he was in good health, he supported himself and his family by retrieving golf balls from the water traps in all of the plush golf courses between Texas and Missouri. His teenage son has recently dropped out of school to follow in his father's vocational footsteps. The mother completed only 3 years of schooling. She apparently loves her children, but has very few skills to serve them capably. She too has begun to drink more and more heavily of late. The family's only income in recent years has been from various welfare checks. And then you glance at the children who are playing on the floor. They're paying no attention to the old secondhand TV, which is blaring in the background. And in particular, you wonder about the fourth grader, for this is the one through whom the church has made a recent contact. And you begin to wonder whether the school and the Sunday school that she has just joined is going to be able somehow to help her and her family break the cycle which is already dictating the direction which this next generation must plod. She smiles and scrapes the dirty scab on her knee. And as you leave, you try to sort out the pieces. There's no sense of hostility in the family. They're not fighting the rest of the world. There's going to be no riot here. At most, you sense a tired, apathetic acceptance of the whole lot. That's the way the world is. This is how you live it, day by day. Now, if this second case pulls from you no more than a sense of curiosity or possibly of sympathy, then we're missing the key point that we'd like to explore in our midst together tonight. For you see, we've taken hold here of a problem of greater magnitude than simply an isolated case of poverty or the effects of limited education or of excessive drinking or of any other symptom you may want to pick out of this family. Now, we don't remove responsibility from the individual when we insist that attitudes and behaviors are the products of a social experience, so that a youngster from a privileged home may reject the gifts bestowed on him and slowly destroy himself. The possibility is his. But the child growing up in the home that we have just visited has never received the fundamental skills to compete in modern America. And as many of you know from your own experience in your reading, on the day that each of these children entered the first grade, they were already behind their equals, their peers in another part of that city. But the child growing up in the home that we have just described has never received these skills to compete. The ignorance, the illness, the lack of basic hygiene, the mismanagement, the failure to see oneself and purpose in life, all of these will permanently stunt the lives of the children who are growing up in this setting. Now, as I try to put myself in your position, I imagine a few of you are asking at this point, aren't you simply assuming certain smug middle-class judgments? Aren't you comparing these kids with your kids back at home? And I think the answer is no. We're dealing not just with a smug judgment that when they become middle-class, everything is settled, but rather we're facing realistically the fact of how these children are going to grow up in our society as presently given. Will you take one further step with me? The man of compassion who would seek to help has to see below the surface then where the manifestation of immediate need in this family broadened out to touch the institutions of that city. On this level, you see, we investigate the whole economic picture and ask, for example, about the employment possibilities for such men of limited productive and personal skill. This is more than a personal problem. What about this whole level of structure? We further move back to ask about the educational system, which failed to truly engage those parents a full generation before, who are in turn are now passing this on to yet another generation. We find ourselves asking about community agencies, which have not yet been able to impart fundamental concepts of personal hygiene, of household management to this family. We further inquire about the housing conditions and ask why these are permitted to exist in the first place, not only on the part of the owner of the building, but on the part of the city inspectors who don't report violations. And at this point, the circle closes as we ask finally about the church. We speculate about it where the first tenuous contact with the family has been made. Has it played any role in that community in the past? Will it now be able to touch the lives of this one family in a meaningful way? It seems to me the picture begins to emerge with some degree of clarity. Let me try it on and then argumentally and later in other settings. We have here taken hold, you see, of a problem whose roots go into many sectors of this particular community. And any help which is addressed only to the surface needs of the family will remain inadequate. And moreover, it can even become harmful if thereby the fundamental issues are not faced. May I be more specific? In the immediate future, a number of churches are going to try to help, to serve in a concrete way human need by setting up remedial reading centers for children from such disadvantaged homes and schools. But you see, you may be actually compounding the difficulty unless along with this immediate help you move to the long-range help of forcing the responsible agencies to face their assigned task of providing an education for all children entrusted to their care. It is ultimately not our task to provide remedial reading. The problems then are those that are the concerns of the group as well as the individual, we're trying to say. And furthermore, the first step towards solution, or at least any partial sort of amelioration, demands the patience to see the cause of the difficulty as well as its more obvious manifestations. Now, as I listen to some of you talk, you are quite critical of the fact that many of the conventional ways that we have tried to move into problems of this type are beginning to prove inadequate. Many of the personal and institutional patterns through which we are attempting to manifest love to other people are becoming antiquated and possibly sentimental. Now, we're not quarreling with the good intention of these people. We're not talking about their goodwill, who want to utilize a particular channel of response. But it seems to me what you are asking here is how faithful leadership moves through to the point where rigorous analysis demands that we look at the old patterns to test their truth and their adequacy for today. We're asking, as you've noticed, for more than just generalizations. Convinced that love must be demonstrated in service, we find that very specific questions are being addressed regarding the form which such service might take in this day. I recognize a few of you in the group as professionals in this area. And as you know better than some of us, you don't pursue this question long before you're dealing with very knotty problems regarding the role of the church over against other agencies, particularly governmental agencies. Perhaps one of the greatest barriers to effective service has centered about the role of the church in political action, where a type of decision is involved involving the whole political arena. But no amount of pious talk, as we were observing in our little culture hour yesterday, can obscure the fact that any given decision made regarding social security, housing for the aged, ADC, any one of these, will affect more people for good or for evil than will all Lutheran and, as a matter of fact, all Protestant welfare work for the next century. Private charity can no longer cope with the dimensions of the problem as they have moved in upon us at the present time. And so we're seeking for some definition of service, which can include all of this, the immediate act of love that one of you as a wife gives to the family next door. No agency involved, but we have to define service broadly enough that it includes finally those channels through which we are dealing with group over against group as well as the individual. There are three questions I've tried in another setting to apply to this particular question I'd like to share with you at this time. And it seems to me these are three questions that we're wrestling with as we are trying to find our way through this very knotty problem. And may I say again, if it's not already apparent, that what I'm attempting to do with you is simply try on one type of answer. I find that, you know, the person in the room with whom I'm in probably greatest accord in this area would say things quite differently, would have another list of priorities in his mind. And I think over against saying, you're right or I'm right, it's a matter of this sharing to ask at what point do we begin to clarify our needs. For example, to all of you involved in the area of systematics, our beseeching need, we would like you to sit down and begin to address some of the dimensions of this problem. For those of you involved in exegesis, and so we go, you see, across the line. I want to make very clear as we're saying this, this is one practitioner's attempt to say, here are some of the needs that we see. Here's one very simple way of beginning to put it together, but now each one of us has to pick up part of the handle as we move together. I'd like to have you ask, for example, about the question of primary needs. This is one point at which this is so often stopped in the past. How crucial is the diaconic work of the church, the whole service ministry. To what extent, for example, have we consciously or unconsciously pitted this sort of work against, for example, the task of evangelism, the task of worship, the task of nurture, or any one of the rest of these? Our Lord was able to describe his entire ministry as a diaconia. But notice, for example, let's just pick up this one, this tension that seems to be there between evangelism. If we take a given stand, will we really be in a position of neutrality over against the entire community? Bill Stringfellow, whose own life, I think, has borne immediate testimony in this area, has put it into one simple sentence in this way. May I share it with you? Evangelism consists of loving another human being in a way which represents to him the care of God for his particular life. Evangelism rests upon the appeal to another man to remember his own creation, to remember who made him and for whom he was made. Evangelism is the event in which a Christian confronts another man in a way which assures the other man that the new life which he observes in the Christian is vouchsafed for him as well. You see, the immediate tension which seems to be on the surface begins to dissolve when we ask ourselves on a lower level what's really involved in the dynamics. And so as we line up the primary goals of that which we're trying to do on every level, which is a group of Christians we may be working together, it seems to me that this note of compassion has to be apparent. Many of our Lord's parables highlighted the need for doing as well as hearing. The final judgment is portrayed as an examination of one's service. Disciples are admonished to be merciful. Discipleship will be characterized by love. The early church believed that it was more blessed to give than to receive, its members selling their possessions for the community. The strong are to bear the infirmities of the weak. And finally, St. Paul portrays all the work of God within man as culminating in a self-offering service. Timothy is told that one who doesn't care for his own has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. And so you go, you see, Peter, James, John elaborate even more emphatically on this central theme of service, of compassion, of ministry to the whole man. And yet somehow it has become possible for us to define the work of the church in such a way that this overpowering witness is occasionally lost. The evangelistic task, as we said, is occasionally pitted against this very diaconic task. So much for the first. How central in your thinking, as you envision ministry, is this work of service? Secondly, the question confronts us, and here's the knottiest one of all. Where does it center? Where and what is the agent? Is it to be only the individual, or is it to be at any point the collective church? Now, we're not suggesting as the alternative to this that some Christians are seriously arguing against acts of love and service. The disagreement has arisen in our midst, however, very sharply regarding the responsibility, who is to carry out this task. And the traditional Lutheran answer has been strong in its insistence that the individual Christian alone is to operate in the social and political realm. And we have had until very recently explicit statements in our literature which has denied this ever to be the work of a congregation. Historically, you will notice, the pattern for offering aid to every group, to the orphans, to the sick, the poor, in our country was to form a voluntary society which would pick up this particular task. It was never the church as such who did this. The third and last question in terms of the scope that we would like to address ourselves to, is the comprehensiveness of the scope, and this is the second of the knotty problems, it seems to me. Is diaconia, this whole service ministry, perhaps we should define it as the helpfulness which the Christian renders his fellow man in the love of Christ, The question, is it to be restricted to direct service? Or is it possible that to render the truest and most helpful service, one must also be concerned with the indirect service which comes through the structures of society as a result of, and now the topic as you asked for it, namely, of social action? Is it possible that if this service focuses upon the need of the other and seeks to minister to the greatest amount of need possible, is a Christian then not under an obligation also to seek corporate action for the alleviation of social ills? I think, as many of you know from your own contact, this is a problem bothering the brethren in the ministry now more than almost any other problem in this broad category. To what extent will our churches become involved in certain areas of community organization? This service, which is to face the realities, it seems to me, of the latter third of the 20th century, must utilize that which a number of you represent, namely social welfare work directed to the immediate physical and temporal needs of the individual, but it seems to me must also include the social action which is addressed to the underlying condition which has produced the situation itself. May I put this as crassly as I can, since we're observing Christmas also at this time? Perhaps at one time, the Christmas basket was a useful device for conveying Christian helpfulness. Today, it has become virtually obsolete and inappropriate. In our society, the Christian who would show mercy is going to find himself involved with the tangled question of justice and exploitation, of employment and housing, which produce and perpetuate the given cases of poverty. Now, utilizing this little schema by way of background, I'd like to share a couple of simple observations. Some of them that have been developing, some of the last ones, frankly, shaped just within the last day. As some of you are becoming a little tense, may we suggest relax. We all are up here, you may as well be back there. First, out of several of these observations, the work of service that we're describing has moved within this recent period from a position of being an admirable extra task of the church to the point where it's becoming and being evaluated as a symptom of a church's vitality. The Lutheran Church has experienced periods, as you all well know, when an emphasis upon a strict dogmatic definition was occasionally set in opposition to a rich life of faith and of service. There have been times to which all of you can point when the Lutheran Church has remained quiet in the face of appalling conditions of human need. What's happened in our own period? Recently, the disparity between the affluence of the organizational church and given disadvantaged segments of the American population has forced us to re-examine the church at its very heart. The post-war temptation, familiar to all of you, to flee areas of the city which were rapidly becoming blighted, our frank inability to make meaningful contact with vast segments of the population who differed from an older group of Lutherans, forced us to take stock of our very goals. You've already noticed through the literature, which I notice so many of you are reading, that during the 50s, the changes began to take place. One denomination after the other suddenly rediscovered the inner city. It became the popular area to pursue. A half generation of young clerics left seminaries across the nation and turned their backs upon what they were calling suburban country clubs with stained glass windows to become shepherds of the poor and the downtrodden. Occasionally this was exaggerated, but I think within these men you see a type of symbol. This was the group that began talking about servanthood. They talked about the life of the Christian and of the church as being a reenactment from below of the servant shape of Jesus Christ. This is the generation that was reading Bonhoeffer and taking him seriously. They began to ask the dimensions of a world come of age. And the more they faced the complexity of the urban scene, and frankly, the more they sensed their own relative helplessness to affect anything approximating basic change, to provide genuine help, the more intensely they moved into this posture of being servants. Living increasingly at the edge of the world. They came to know part of this pain, part of the struggle, and also part of the frustration and the aspirations of people. They were longing to help, but frequently discovered that in spite of their intentions, they were not reaching through. This is the group that had very little patience with the religious enterprise. I add parenthetically, it was rather interesting to watch these angry young men as after a decade they become angry middle-aged men. Interesting to watch them after having fought all of the machinery for this time as they have begun to move into the positions of leadership within this machinery. And so I guess the next batch coming along 15 years behind are saying, you too have sold out to a form of the establishment. But there were people to be served, and for them this service could never again become an extra. They tried to preserve, as one of my colleagues has put it, sitting loose in the saddle, in order to make sure that they would be able to truly serve. May I summarize this first point then? As a close corollary to what we've been saying, this work of a serving ministry, and I recognize the fact that these words are simply three repetitions of the same concept, has increasingly moved from the province of being the task of a special interest group of those who may like this sort of thing, like stamp collecting, to the point where it has become the task of the whole church. As one exploratory study in another Lutheran body phrased it, this has marked the transition of diaconia from an option of a society to becoming an office of the church. The second thought I'd like to share. Much of the concern with social issues has arisen from a deepened awareness of need resulting from the increased speed of social change, which has acutely intensified some problems. I'm trying to take a broader look now. Churches representing a variety of theological persuasions have begun to confront questions of race, of poverty, health and welfare, of management and labor, of automation and unemployment, of a whole complex of problems in the church-state arena, of political radicalism, of the question of peace and nuclear armaments. I like to say that, as I see it, much of this has a certain first-generation quality about it. This is to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the churchmen seem not to respond to these needs out of a motivation that grew essentially theologically. It did not arise, I'm trying to say, out of a particular theological system of ethics. But in most cases, the action appears to be running ahead of the theology. Simply put, the need was there, the group began to respond, and now they're asking, what are we really doing? How do we interpret this theologically? With all of the strength and weakness that's obviously involved in such an action. To some, as a result, the theologian has become a symbol of scorn. A well-intentioned antiquarian who frankly has no contribution to make what this group considers the major issues confronting the church. It's possible to gather a group together this size in some Protestant denominations in which they would be convinced there is no theology that can speak meaningfully to what we're really asking. I think among the larger group, however, there's a great desire to affirm the theological base which supports their action. They're aware of the prime weakness of the social gospel movement of another age, namely, that there was no adequate theological undergirding. You remember that when Walter Rauschenbusch attempted to correct this deficiency when he finally wrote a theology for the social gospel, it was apparent that the remedy was too weak and that it came too late. The ethical superstructure was completed years before the endeavor came to undergird it theologically. The issues, however, have demanded attention right now. The speed of change in today's world has made it clear that the pace at which the church has made their contribution in the past were inadequate, and that the voice of the church always seemed to be heard after the rest of the world had already resolved that given issue. Moreover, Christians were taking seriously the gospel's claim over the whole realm of being and confessing a Lord whose imperium is not restricted to man's interior or personal life, nor his authority to the Christian community. Recent approaches then stand in sharp distinction, it would seem to me, to any earlier sentimental attempt to, quote, Christianize the social order. You may be interested here in the attempt, for example, of the Lutheran Church in America to interpret some of this as a rather extended footnote right now, to answer the question that arose out of their parishes, namely, if the church is not going to be diverting its attention from its primary task of preaching the gospel and administering the sacraments. As many of you have found, this is almost the first question which arises as you try to move out on the level of a parish. And this group says, rather correctly, it would appear to me, there are other agencies in our society, perhaps better equipped, to do the job which now the church belatedly sees as part of its task. May I share with you the four answers which the Board of Social Ministry of the LCA utilized to speak to a lay group. Number one, the church focuses its attention, they said, upon people. It is not the function of the church to establish improved social conditions as such. There are other organizations better situated to effect this type of change. But the church must always ask what's happening to persons because of the attitudes in others, because of the social circumstance in which they live. Seeing people in need, very simply, they cannot walk by on the other side. Secondly, the church witnesses to the love of Jesus Christ in all of the individual and group relationships of life. But in many cases, probe now this word love, love must first express itself in the form of justice. Love is always ready to do more than justice, however, it can never do less. A large number of the issues facing us, for example, in the realm of racial and cultural groups, have to be resolved first on this level of justice. Number three, a problem that I think has been a great one for our synod, churchmen must go beyond a concern for the so-called moral issues, such attacks as those upon gambling, salacious literature, Sunday closing laws, and the like. Now, what's the real problem here? Indeed, on some of these, the church may have to take a given stand. But the danger is that she restricts her efforts to this sort of issue and fail to grapple, frankly, with the bigger, more complex issues that may radically affect far more lives. And furthermore, this earlier approach always places the church in a position where she is tempted to be simply judgmental. We are always rapping the knuckles in an obnoxious way of the society on the outside, and this is all. Number four, there are times when it is appropriate for the church to take a corporate action, they said to one another, in behalf of justice and human welfare. This action will always come on the level where needed, maybe on the level of the local community, maybe on the national level. But the church's witness to be effective is going to be both supportive of some actions and critical of others. Number three, the third of these bigger ideas. The service of the church must continue its movement from what it was in the past, a dealing with immediate cases of need where an ad hoc need arose, to the more primary level of prevention. Notice how this developed. In the past, when there was sickness or fire or hurricane, the Christian community moved in with personal help. But now we've become aware of the fact that certain types of need have developed their own culture. And such a culture is impervious to the isolated efforts of goodwill, which has often characterized our help in the past. And therefore, the need for study, for analysis, for experimental approaches of whole task forces to test the methods and then the concerted effort of vast numbers in order to begin to change the value as well as the attitude, as well as the obvious level of behavior of whole subpopulations within our culture. Let's use as an illustration the point made by a man from the University of Chicago, Hess, as he talked about the rehabilitation of the welfare classes. He extended the thesis that we originally had, that namely poverty in our country has become a culture, This is to say, it's a way of life which is passed on to next generations. So that we see that the economic and the social and educational poverty is socialized in early childhood. One learns to live in a certain fashion. And he argues effectively that our present policy of dealing with poverty doesn't eliminate it at all, but simply institutionalizes it, and thus is in the process of creating a permanent welfare class. Just consider for a second the typical approach of agencies in the past, including the church. We're always dealing with the symptom, unwed mothers, dealing with problems of children from broken homes, dealing with delinquents, with school dropouts, with illiterates, with alcoholics. And rarely have we moved in to the more preventive level. And when the church attempts to work on this more basic level, it's forced to sharpen the definition of its own role. And this is where one of the great problems centers. How does it stand over against the other agencies, private, state, federal, which are at work in these various levels at the present time? In the past, we often simply ran programs in competition with, or at least parallel to those of other groups. But today, brethren, because of the vastness of the need, coordination is needed as never before. And can we take one more step and say it to one another, the very recognition that the concern of the church is with the whole area of life, that which we affirmed as a synod this summer, is going to cause us to move onto many strange battlefields where you're going to be standing side by side with many very strange fighting comrades. At times, churchmen have reacted aggressively to the awareness that other groups were helping. How strange that the church would want to restrict service to its own half-hearted efforts. It was many years ago that McGrane observed very simply that the church should be grateful for what other agencies are doing, but he concludes, this never relieves the church of its responsibility because to serve is part of the church's nature. The church remains then the institution which might maintain the motivation, part of the structure, the flexibility, the judgment to serve in a unique fashion along with all the other groups which are currently at work. The fourth out of these five observations has seen the first movement of the Lutheran Church from an exclusive concern with welfare work to these very precarious battlefronts of social action. I involve your consideration here in the most critical way that you've been listening all evening. When one becomes seriously involved in helping those who are submerged at this lowest level now of the social, the educational, the economic, the political scale, he's forced to the conclusion that any help which is designed to be more than the gesture of goodwill is going to have to break this cycle, this chain that's been there. As I tried to put it in one of the Lutheran Hour broadcasts this summer, if I can pick up one paragraph from this. There's an unbroken chain of inferior health, inferior education, inferior employment, inferior housing, and an inferior or non-existent political voice. And then we're dealing with those who are at the bottom. A few escape. We sagely judge them sociologically to be upwardly mobile. The very few who have caught the vision, you see, of another way of life. But for the great mass of the children born at the bottom of the pack, even today with all of our programs, they appear to be destined to spend their entire lives there. So that, brethren, the goal is to break the vicious cycle at some point. Because the chain usually involves self-defeating images of themselves, a lack of available models to them of what another mode of life, of the ultimate resignation to one's lot, the impetus for change has to usually come from the outside, and here is where, within the church, we are in the unique position to serve. For as I look at some of my younger brethren in the ministry, who are standing and serving in these positions, I've discovered that these men, once sitting where you're sitting now, who have begun to stand with their people totally, have found themselves fighting for them. There are some Lutheran pastors who have been thrown into jail, whom 5 years ago, knowing them as I know some of you now, would have been the last ones I would have ever expected to find in this position. And yet, out of a sense of church, out of a sense of ministry, out of a sense of their own dedication to these people, they have found themselves in positions where they were fighting with them as well as simply issuing types of pronouncements. So that indignation is felt, as one of these young pastors phrased it, when housing inspectors are instructed to overlook the violations in the midst of hardcore slums, when narcotics traffic reaches out to another youngster in your parish, one of the kids that you knew well, when 15-year-old girls are bought into buying a piece of life and paying for it with their own bodies, when the youngster, the boy who has caught the vision of the body of Christ, is rounded up indiscriminately with others simply because of his race, when 17-year-olds with good school records are still reading like fourth graders, when defeat has already seen the eyes of the young dropout for whom no job is ever going to open, indignation then begins to move into action. For in each one of these cases, you're dealing with a problem which is basically bigger than the problem of a single individual. Structures and institutions within society are perpetuating forms and patterns of exploitation. Unhappily, it was not the church which came to the fore a half dozen years ago or a dozen years ago to call our country to an awareness of this fact. But they were segments, you recall, of what we have summarily dismissed as the world. But here was the world showing a compassion, a desire to fight for justice, which should have characterized us as Christians. Here were people taking very seriously those caught in hardcore poverty, and they were not condescending, they were not sentimental, they were not paternalistic, but in brutally realistic fashion, they saw how those who had arrived in our industrialized, urbanized culture were able to protect themselves politically and make sure that their concerns were safeguarded, whereas those at the bottom were politically voiceless. Those who were concerned within our churches have begun to go into the voiceless and have attempted to give to them a voice and an awareness of their potential power, working patiently to convince people of the value of joining together with other voiceless people. And you see the line that we are treading here, which is so very difficult to define. For an organization, they possessed a power which they never had as individuals, but at the same time, you already know what has taken place in some of these. At times, the tactics of these groups seem so raw. Their motivation, frankly, so dependent upon hatred of the advantaged group that many of our churches have stood paralyzed, asking how they can serve and yet how they cannot serve. Your brethren today are asking how they can pronounce their blessing upon some of these endeavors and yet are asking how they can possibly remain on the outside. Such churches found themselves then, to conclude this second last point, out in the streets, where decisions were being made but far more difficult to arrive at than we found in the past, where motivations were terribly mixed, but where life was being lived. As one young pastor in New York put it, if our parishes are to be renewed, we must love the world before we love the church. We have discovered with him that the love of the world must be translated into specific action, or it remains a lofty profession which mocks our lowly practice. And fifth and last, as one who has been observing this from the outside, a change that has struck me is the fact that the tragic bifurcation between theology and life, between liturgy and action, has begun to be bridged. The emerging patterns of diaconic work grow today from a more conscious theology and is nourished for many by a very rich sacramental life.
Be patient with those for whom this is not yet true. Some who represented an earlier generation of Lutheran pastors turned from a frustration which they felt in a theology which was not aiding them in answering the questions that some of these pioneers were asking 25 years ago. They found it so sterile in producing compassion. But their work, I think we would have to say, has suffered from a theology which has been too thin to support patterns of service which are going to be adequate for our day. You, their sons, follow with a much richer theology today. You are, in a deeper sense, consciously churchmen. More of you find worship central in your personal and your vocational lives. The finest examples of you are those, it appears to me, who are confessionally Lutheran and yet Catholic in your outlook. You are able to enter into dialogue with the Roman Catholic on the one side and the Protestant on the other. And moreover, you are able to meet both in the level of theology as well as a practical program. For you are the ones who have begun to say to all of us again that the greatest need of the Church to perform her ministry of service more effectively lies not simply in a new technique, a new program, or even a new insight. For these are our brethren who are calling for a new look at the gospel. The renewal you are insisting must be a theological renewal. I've shared with a couple of you privately and in another setting the fact that one of the most significant addresses I've heard in the course of the last 18 months was delivered by an Episcopalian priest, John Harmon by name, Packard Manse, in Boston. A man who's been deeply involved with the inner city life of that particular community. His entire address was a cogently argued theological treatment of the work of the Church in the city. I still recall how he began this address to an entire gathering of Roman Catholics with only a couple of us representing any other group. His opening words, Jesus Christ. In these two words, all of human life is summed up. The life that the Church lives for the sake of the world, and the life that the world lives for the sake of the Church. He began then with the fact of the death and the resurrection of our incarnate Lord, with the peace that has been established among all men, and relentlessly he pursued the implications into the facets of the misshapen life of the Church and the broken lives of those within the city. He called the Church, which has become so ecclesiocentric that she's grown blind to the deepest needs of society, back to theology and to worship. For the Church at worship is the Church learning in each age what it means to serve and to be served by humanity. We're saying then, brethren, as we conclude, many factors have driven the Church back to this awareness of service. It's uneven at the present time. But regardless of the initial impulse, this service is going to remain partial and will be subject to being untrue to the true nature of the Church unless it is nourished and corrected by the Word of God. I have a personal concern in two directions. First, every generation must beware of apostasy. And God forgive me for the judgment, but I strongly suspect that some men who are entering the service professions today that I've met within and without the Church are doing so because their personal faith is bankrupt, not sure of God, too overpowered by doubt to proclaim the gospel. They take not the radical step of leaving the Church, but remaining within the ranks of the clergy. But from this point forth, their relationship has very little to the apostle who determined to know nothing among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified. And may I add, immediately, there are an equal number who are moving into these very areas because of the richness of their faith. And the other danger that the renewal within theology is enabling us to avoid, the tragic separation between renewal and creativity in program,
over against a rich, fermenting theological given. Without this source, most of our thrilling service projects of the 60s are going to be seen by future generations, I fear, as but another manifestation of the desperate techniques and the despairing schemes of a floundering church. Our need, then, is for a new vision. Our need is for a courage and conviction. Roger Shin said, "The temptation for the church in such a time is to abdicate moral responsibility and to adopt a helpless stance in the face of overwhelming problems." The church then has a unique role to play in her service. As servant, she must stand with the poor and the oppressed as well as the other group. As the body of Christ, she must manifest the compassion which our Lord himself showed in his earthly ministry. As prophet, she must speak to the structures of society and at times creatively move around them when it becomes apparent that new forms are needed. Some of you are right as you say we've got to wait for the leading of the Spirit, but at the same time we have to act when the Spirit moves. Service is more than extra. It involves this whole area of action. In a concluding paragraph, 7.5 centuries ago, or 7.5 centuries rather, before the time of our Lord, both religion and society were bankrupt. It was a day vaguely like ours, a period of prosperity, a period of expansion, but a day in which the poor existed like animals over against the midst of plenty. And out of the Judean wilderness, God called a man to bring his judgment upon the people. And through him, God said to that day, and perhaps God is saying it yet to ours, "I hate, I despise your feasts, and I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Take away from me the noise of your songs, and to the melody of your harps I will not listen, but let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream."